Jesse Prince is Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the City University in New York, specializing in philosophy of mind and philosophy of psychology. He is the author of The Conscious Brain and The Emotional Construction of Morals, both on Oxford University Press. In this interview and discussion, he addresses the historical study of consciousness, the importance of the division between the conscious and the subconscious, as well as awareness for definitions of consciousness, the role of emotions in consciousness, the intellectual problems found in panpsychism, and how philosophy in conjunction with neuroscience can help us better understand the phenomenon of the mind. Jesse, consciousness has a very long and contentious history, particularly in philosophy, perhaps more so in the 20th century with neuroscience and cognitive science. But how's the best way, in your opinion, to define consciousness and therefore the best way to start studying it?
Well, I think for a long time we didn't even know that consciousness existed because we didn't know that the unconscious existed. So we just had the mind, which seemed to give us a direct window onto the world. So people weren't particularly puzzled about how the mind generates experience. And I think with the increasing belief in unconscious processing, people started to discover that there's this contrast, that some information is processed in the absence of awareness, other information seems to be processed with awareness. And that distinction, awareness, unawareness, became a topic of theoretical interest. And by the 20th century, I think a lot of philosophers were thinking that not only was this a question of interest, but it was of the deepest and most urgent interest. As Tom Nagel said, the problem of consciousness is what makes the mind-body problem hard. It's a problem that's so difficult to explain, how matter can give rise to something experiential, that it's been compared to the deepest mysteries that human beings have ever unearthed. And I think as we moved into the 21st century, what really happened is people in various different fields, psychology, neuroscience, even some of the other social sciences like anthropology or sociology, became interested in trying to unravel the mysteries of consciousness. And we ended up with really a very broad research program, interdisciplinary research program, that was designed to crack this question. And in my own view, consciousness isn't something that we can particularly well define. It's rather something we can point to, and we can point to it by this conscious-unconscious contrast. So if you look at work, say, on subliminal perception, which began in earnest in the 1950s, people would present individuals with objects before their eyes very briefly, and they would find that even though viewers insisted they saw nothing, there was evidence that this information was being processed. And that led to questions, what's the source of this contrast? What's the threshold that makes the difference between consciousness and unconsciousness? I think philosophers have thought that they can answer that question, that they can try and make progress under understanding that threshold through pure reflection, through traditional philosophical methods, which are the use of reason and contemplation, analysis of concepts, and so on. But I think scientists quickly realized that, in fact, their tools had something to offer here, that we can't simply introspect and figure out what makes the difference between being conscious and not, because that divide itself is something that we don't have direct conscious access to. The mechanisms that make the difference between consciousness and unconsciousness are themselves unconscious. And to that extent, we need this multidisciplinary effort. We need to bring psychology and neuroscience to bear in order to make progress on a question that might seem philosophical.
As you said there, one of the keys there was discovering the difference between awareness and unawareness, i.e. having a conscious experience like you and I are having right now, and then perhaps a subconscious experience where we're not actually consciously aware of what our subconscious mind is doing. And now in the history of philosophy, when it came to mind, as you said, it was kind of treated as just one monolithic concept. And now we at least have this divide in terms of explaining, for example, everyone knows the hard problem and the issues where some philosophers who negate a full material explanation of the mind always say, how could you ever explain qualia from the first person, etc. Do you think that this division between awareness and unawareness, the conscious and subconscious, lends itself more to a materialist explanation or a non-materialist explanation? Because at least you could say that if you're having trouble explaining qualia, which is as a first person sensation that you're aware of, can be problematic, but then you can also point to the fact that your brain is doing stuff that you're not actually aware of as in the first person. So that would indicate that perhaps there's more to just explaining qualia and conscious sensation. There is mechanisms at work at the material level that you can't just pin on, oh, why qualia is so hard to explain. How do you feel about that?
I'm glad you used the word mechanism, because I think for me and for a lot of researchers in the area, that's really the key. If you think about the mind as a mechanism, like a television set or a computer, some physical object that can be described at various levels of analysis. So you can describe a television set as projecting its images or broadcasting, or you can look at the underlying physical structures that make that possible. I think the mind is much the same. And it's very feasible from a scientific perspective to take a very familiar process like having a conscious experience and try and look at that using the instruments of science to see what the underlying mechanism is. I think dualistic approaches, any non-physical approach, is really a non-starter. It's a kind of residue of an old, more, I think, supernatural worldview that treated mental life as somehow connected to an immortal soul, an enduring spirit, something that defied physical explanation. But whenever we've taken that attitude towards things in nature, we've sort of systematically seen those more supernatural styles of explanation be displaced and replaced by scientific mechanistic explanations. And I see absolutely no reason why we shouldn't expect the same fate for the study of consciousness.
To a certain extent, I'd agree. I mean, certain dualistic positions are clearly a supernatural division between some untouchable mental soul that kind of seeps in through your brain, so to speak, which a lot of contemporary philosophers don't agree with. There are certain dualistic positions that have problems with how we come to define consciousness in the first place. So to a certain extent, they play off the ambiguity from that. In terms of having this subconscious that we're not consciously aware of that still drives mechanisms, I'm willing to a certain extent to admit that can take us down the path that we can be, for example, just computerized robots in our head, that how you experience yourself is an illusion, that kind of area. I am willing to perhaps go down that path. There are obviously certain issues between dualists and non-dualists. It's hard to just classify the two to break them off there, but I do think there is more likelihood at this moment in time that we'll discover that both conscious experience and the subconscious experience has its own mechanistic productions that arise from the material brain. As the philosopher Quentin Smith said, no one's ever observed the mind outside a brain, which is a quite interesting point. Going back to some of this work, I know you do a bit on philosophy of psychology as well. How can this help us understand the conscious mind and the unconscious mind in the area of mind?
Well, in a way, I think the question of the unconscious and conscious mind is initially best tackled by psychology. So I see the strategy that has most promise as a two-stage strategy. One is to understand the psychological conditions. One can even think of them as experimental conditions that make the difference between consciousness and unconsciousness. So if you're running a psychology experiment, what you're going to try and do is look for what manipulation, what change in your stimulus conditions would lead to a stimulus being unconscious. So you present something in a way that's clearly visible, and then you alter it. Maybe you make it less vivid, maybe you present it more quickly, and you look for what makes that difference. Or another method would be to present a participant in your study with a stimulus and then give them a second task, what's called a dual task, a simultaneous activity that occupies them in a way, and look for which of those activities interfere with consciousness. And I think in this stage of the process, you can actually make quite a lot of progress. You can really identify the psychological changes that make the difference for experiencing or not experiencing the stimulus. And to be more specific about that, I think psychology has really been extremely successful in pointing to a particular process in consciousness research, which is attention. So we all know anecdotally that, for instance, in the context of a magician doing sleight of hand or a pickpocket, or even in the case of our own tendency to find our minds drifting through distraction, failures to attend lead to failures of consciousness. If you're not attending to something, it won't be experienced. So experimental settings can be used to really refine that hypothesis and try and figure out exactly how attention works, what are its temporal parameters, and to what extent does it lead to the elimination of consciousness. I've been persuaded by that research that attention is the key, that attention is the sine qua non for consciousness. With it, we're conscious. Without it, we're not. But that doesn't yet give us the mechanism. That tells us something about the psychological process, but not how that process is actually implemented in a physical device like the brain. So the second phase is to bring in the resources of neuroscience. And once we've identified a candidate like attention, the path is straightforward. Really, our goal then is to simply do the neuroscience of attention and figure out what are the mechanisms that make the difference between attended and unattended information as it enters the brain. And I think there, too, tremendous progress has been made. We know down to the level of ion channels what's going on when the brain is in an attentive state. We can look at how cells modulate activity under conditions of attention and inattention and see not only what they're doing, but we can see it in a way that gives us new perspective on how consciousness works. We can start to understand the reason why consciousness has certain temporal thresholds. To give you one example of this, there's some evidence that one of the mechanisms of attention, one of the things that goes on when we attend, is a kind of synchrony of neurons. Neurons start to fire together. They start to work together. And that synchrony takes place at a particular temporal threshold, what's called the gamma band, which is about anywhere between 60 hertz or 60 cycles a second on up to about 150. And so neurons are turning on and off all the time. And when neurons start to turn on and off at about 60 times a second, and they synchronize together, we get attention. Now, two things can be learned from that. First of all, that cycling pattern basically corresponds to the threshold of conscious experience. You can show that the minimum time it takes for a stimulus to be present in order for it to be consciously perceived corresponds to the number of oscillations in a second required for attention. And the second thing we learn is that when neurons fire together, they are able to send a signal forward more readily. So if you imagine you're at a football match and everybody is yelling something completely different, it'll be a terrible din. You won't make sense of anything that's being said. But if a group of fans all chat the name of their team at the same time, West Ham, West Ham, West Ham together, then it suddenly becomes audible. That ability to create signal in a noisy environment is basically what the neurons are doing. And if you ask yourself, why attention? Why is attention so crucial for consciousness? The answer falls into place. Attention at the neural level is synchrony, which means signal. Attention is what allows information to get out of the perceptual systems and broadcast to the rest of the mind, making that information available to us, resulting in conscious awareness.
You've just explained how we've got this psychological attention that corresponds to certain thresholds in neural activity, and that explains how attention comes into conscious experience. Is there any mechanisms that can at least help us to understand how the unconscious then becomes aware, or at least take in data? Obviously, the unconscious can't be aware in our conscious experience, but is there any way that we can learn how we then process stuff subconsciously? Because obviously, you've just given a great example how we do this with conscious experience and attention. How would it work at the unconscious level? What gets filtered, what doesn't, if that's possible to answer?
Great. Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the really fascinating results from recent psychology is that the unconscious is enormously powerful. There's really nothing that can be represented in consciousness that can't be represented in unconsciousness. It's been like a shifting bar. People say, well, we need consciousness to do X, and then we discover it can be done unconsciously. We need consciousness for Y, and then we find unconscious Y. So we thought consciousness was required to bind information together. It turns out that can be done unconsciously. Unconsciousness can perform very elaborate inferences. It can perform complex information processing using multiple sensory sources. Unconscious perception can process color, form, shape, mathematical information, relational information. We can unconsciously make comparative decisions like, is one object larger or smaller than another? So the unconscious seems to be really in its informational or processing capacities pretty unlimited. And that suggests that as soon as information enters the brain, it's really able to avail itself of the full range of processing that we're capable of. And I think for me, what that seems to suggest is that consciousness is a kind of later add-on. The mind's evolved ability to cope with complex information, to make decisions, to adapt to its environment is really in place independently of consciousness. And in fact, this has been a source of some, disheartening discoveries in psychology, because we make so many decisions unconsciously that we begin to worry that our own capacity to control information processing, to deliberate with a kind of freedom of will is seriously limited. And in fact, the decisions made by the unconscious mind are often at odds with the ones that we as conscious agents would really most endorse. An example of this would be work on implicit racism or implicit sexism, where it's shown that even people with the best intentions who are committed to freeing themselves from racial or sexual bias show these forms of bias in their decision-making, because the unconscious processes are using information to make decisions outside of their control. So that's a long answer, but the short answer to your question is what we discover from psychology is that there's no limit to what the unconscious can do, which leads to a puzzle: what is consciousness good for if the unconscious is so powerful?
Because the unconscious acts as almost like a shorthand for when you get in new information, that could be obviously very beneficial in terms of quickly processing data, such as the difference between the size of objects or the instantly knowing a difference between colors. But then it can be problematic if you do want to use your higher conscious reasoning experience on top of it. For example, implicit racism would be a good example of that.
Exactly, yes.
Another expertise of yours is emotions. So what can the study of consciousness, awareness and unawareness tell us about emotions in general and how emotions play another fundamental role in our conscious experience?
Well, emotions had been written off as a kind of residual aspect of our animal nature. I mean, there was a long period of in the early decades of the human sciences where emotions were, if anything, treated as a kind of defect, a kind of irrational force that we needed to exercise or suppress in some way in order to lead successful lives. And I think that there's been really a very radical shift away from that perspective, where emotions are seen as crucial to human decision making. To put it bluntly, we couldn't decide to do anything without emotion, because emotions are what give us preferences. They're what order the world in terms of things that are good and bad, better and worse, things that we want, things that we don't want. Without emotions, we have total indifference, and with indifference, we don't act. We have total inactivity. We have no motivation to do anything. Brain disorders where emotions are impaired lead to that kind of inactivity. There's a condition called akinetic mutism, where in order to deal with intractable pain, neurosurgeons go in and remove part of the brain called the anterior cingulate that's involved with emotional processing. And while the brain can recover from this to some degree, in the early stages after surgery, emotions are seriously dampened. And as a result, people are processing information, even consciously experiencing the world around them, but they don't act. They function as if they're in a coma, when in fact they can hear, comprehend, and process anything that's said to them. They're acting in this way because they become radically apathetic, radically indifferent to the world around them. So we're learning a lot about the function of emotions in decision making. I think with respect to consciousness, interesting questions about the emotions arise. And one of those questions is whether emotions are always conscious or whether they can occur unconsciously. And I said a moment ago that we've been again and again struck by the power of the unconscious. Freud was one of the pioneers of this idea. I mean, he really brought the notion of unconscious processing into popular imagination. But ironically, Freud himself thought that emotions were always conscious. He thought we didn't know why we had certain emotions. We might not even know what the meaning of an emotion was. Or are we feeling angry, or are we feeling aroused? We might experience the state without being able to label it. But he thought the emotions are always going to be consciously felt. And one of the ways in which the science has progressed is we've come to see that emotions can be unconscious too. Just like visual perception, we can have an emotional state without experiencing it. And these emotional states that are unconscious often play a role in decision making. For example, there's been research on drug addiction, where it's been found that if you give a drug addict a trace amount of cocaine that's so small that they can't even experience the pleasure that it would normally give, it can still drive their decisions. It can still lead them to engage in behavior that would seek out more of the dangerous drug. So we do need to recognize that the presence of unconscious emotions opens up the possibility that we're making a lot of decisions about who to interact with, friends to choose, who to trust, what to do in various professional decision makings that involve immediate response with the aid of emotions, but without any conscious awareness of those emotions.
So again, emotions can play another role in kind of effective shorthand for practical decision making. The problems in certain areas of research is dividing them between the conscious and subconscious experience, and again tracing out different mechanisms that cause both. But it is quite apparent that emotions play a fundamental role both consciously and subconsciously.
That's correct.
Just in terms of going forward in the general research, whether it's from philosophy of mind, neuroscience, or cognitive science, what do you think will be the latest developments in these areas in the next decade or so? I know you haven't got a crystal ball, but if you'd like to at least put some of your thoughts on the table.
Well, I think in some ways our knowledge of the conscious brain is already extraordinarily advanced. So if someone said, do we know the psychological and neurobiological mechanisms that correlate, that are associated systematically with conscious experience, I think we can say the answer is yes. Now, there is controversy about this, so people interpret different bodies of evidence differently, but we know so much about the conditions that make us conscious or unconscious at these different levels of analysis that in some sense we can say the mind-body problem has been solved. In some sense we can say that while there are still some competing theories out there that need to be settled, we do have detailed models of the possible mechanisms that underlie conscious experience, and it's just a matter of picking between them. But that's the rosy picture. I mean, we have to have enough humility to recognize that there are still some great unknowns, and some of these unknowns are so fundamental that when we recognize them, we realize that we're really only at the infancy of these lines of inquiry. And I'll give you an example. So a question that might seem obvious, a question we might have expected to be solved long ago, is how do neurons mean? How does a neuron in the brain represent whatever it is that it represents? So imagine having an experience of two different colors, say the color blue and the color red. What's the difference at the neural level between these two states? And the short answer is that we actually don't know. Not only do we not know, but there isn't even a consensus about where to look, where we should find this difference. The kind of cell that carries information about the color red and the kind of cell that carries information about the color green look the same. The cells are very, very similar in their morphology. We can identify which are green cells and which are red cells, that is, which cells light up when presented green or red. But if we actually look at the cells themselves, there's no difference between them. And the standard ways of measuring neural activity also are limited with respect to finding any difference between them. Normally, we just look at cells turning on and off, and we can see cells get excited for colors regardless of what the color is. So mere neural activity, neural excitement, is not going to give us an answer. So what we need to do is look at a much finer grain and say, is there a difference between the way a red cell fires and the way a green cell fires? And there are many possible dimensions of difference. It could be the intensity of the firing. It could be the kind of amplitude of the wave that's caused, the speed. It could be the temporal pattern unfolding over time. And it could be something that's not found in a single neuron, but requires a complex pattern across a large population of neurons. Maybe one of the same cell could be part of a red experience and part of a green experience, depending on the global pattern, rather than the particular cell involved. So I think this is a place where we really need to be investing much more energy. There are some, I think, exciting leads. There are suggestive findings that begin to point to theories of how collections of neurons encode complex information. But there is no orthodox view. There is no received textbook opinion about how neurons carry information that would allow us to say, what is the basis of an experience of one color as opposed to another in the brain?
I'm glad you mentioned previously there the aspect of correlation. Go back to Philosophy of Science 101 and basic causal explanations. As I'm sure you know, a criticism levied at neuroscience is that it only can just produce correlations, and correlations obviously don't amount to causation. How do you feel about this charge, or do you think there's more going on with a wider body of evidence that can allow us to move on behind the debate of just, oh, it's just simple correlations? Is there more to neuroscience imaging that can help us in this area?
Well, I it's a very good question, because I think a lot of the debate between dualists on the one hand and physicalists on the other hangs on this question of explanation. And so a standard charge, as you rightly said, is that once we get the biological correlates, they don't give us any explanatory purchase. We know that they occur at the same time, but without shedding light on the nature of conscious experience, they're left idling. And dualists really emphasize this, because they think that is evidence that we need to go beyond the brain and posit something non-physical in order to explain consciousness. But I think that move is doubly misguided. It's first of all misguided because positing some non-physical stuff provides no explanation itself. So to simply say consciousness is a fundamental feature of the universe, something non-physical, doesn't explain the nature of conscious experience. In fact, it does the opposite. It says we can't explain it. It's just a primitive feature of reality. So it gives up any hope of explanation. But I think, secondly, the neurobiological stories, while not providing complete explanations of conscious experience, are often explaining many, many things at fine levels of detail. So it's not mere correlation. So for example, we can explain various optical illusions. Why does one line look longer than another when they're actually the same? We can explain how bits of information might fade out of consciousness at a particular rate. I mentioned before the example of explaining the threshold of conscious experience. We can even explain things like the temporal properties of conscious experience. It's been known, for example, that if two tones are played very quickly in succession, it can be impossible to order them. We don't know which one came first, which one came second. But features of the neural dynamics that are involved in consciousness and attention can actually shed light on why certain minimal temporal thresholds are required in order to sequence sounds in a particular order. Everything that we find in terms of, say, color contrast effects, where the surrounding color alters the experience of one color, or a phenomenon called interocular suppression, where presenting one thing in one eye while presenting a different thing in the other leads to a temporal fluctuation back and forth between the two. All of these little micro features of how consciousness alters and changes in time can be explained at the neurobiological level. So what we're getting from these mechanistic stories is not just a correlation, but actually an account that explains and predicts features that we report and experience.
Do you feel that given enough time, you're confident enough that at some point or one day in the future we'll be able to explain all of the facets regarding conscious and subconscious experience and how the mechanisms do primarily come from the material brain itself in terms of neurons?
I think what we'll end up with is a partial explanation. I think if you look at philosophical debates, they tend to divide between those who think that the neuroscience will explain everything and those who think it can't explain anything. And I think the truth falls somewhere in the middle. The kinds of examples I was just giving, like the time course of an optical illusion, those things are very easy to explain with the neuroscience. They're difficult in one sense. It's taken a lot of toil to get those explanations, but we can easily see how neural activity, the kind of fluctuation in the biological material, could shed some light on why, say, a certain visual state fades in and out of existence at a particular temporal rate. But if we want to know why a particular neural pattern results in an experience of blue or an experience of red, that difference is really something that I think we won't succeed in explaining. We can explain the shape of color space. We can explain why some colors appear to us to be primary and others appear secondary. We can explain how colors mix and interact. We can explain why color experience fades when you stare at a uniform color for a period of time. But we can't explain why the colors have the particular qualities that we do. In a way, that's a kind of brute fact. I think if we're confident that we're getting some explanation from these neurobiological stories, we should form the conclusion that the brain is the basis of consciousness. There is no remainder. There is nothing more. But if that's true, then it's just going to turn out to be a fact of the universe, that a certain neural activity, a certain pattern is the experience of red, and another pattern is the experience of green. And beyond that, there will be nothing further to say.
On that point, so if we are just fundamentally reducing it to the brain, that would be almost a mirror version of the argument that's saying that consciousness is something fundamental in the universe. But at least you're positing that if we reduce it all to the brain, at least that has more of an explanatory role than just, say, panpsychism.
Yeah, that's right. I think in panpsychism, it's the idea that there's this irreducible feature of the world that is conscious experience and it can be found everywhere. To me, it's a kind of embarrassment. It makes me depressed to think that philosophers have been attracted to a view that's so extravagant, it's so outlandish. We think about scientific methodology as being governed by a principle of parsimony, where we're not supposed to posit things beyond those that are required. And panpsychism goes in the opposite extreme. It starts positing consciousness everywhere. And, to me, the most striking thing about consciousness is how rare it is. If you look at psychological processing, you find that very, very little activity in the brain is associated with conscious experience. So to suddenly say that consciousness is actually everywhere in the brain, and not just in the brain, everywhere in the physical universe, in the way subatomic particles are everywhere in the universe, strikes me as totally unfounded. And I think what it suggests is a kind of desperation that occurs when we get to a point in inquiry, when we feel like there is this remainder that I mentioned. There is some aspect of experience, like the redness of red, that science has been unable to explain. But I think if we have to choose between the views that say redness just is a brain process, and a view that says, no, redness is made out of some fundamental other kind of matter that we can't measure with any scientific instruments, but is everywhere in the universe, that makes no impact on things like atomic mass, atomic weight, the rules of physics, the causal order. I think it's overwhelmingly obvious that the first theory is more attractive by every stricture of science and reason than the second theory. The second theory I mentioned explains nothing, but it posits entities beyond reason. One of the really exciting things about being in the academy now, by being engaged in consciousness research or research in other dimensions of the mind, is it is a collaborative effort. And I think philosophers are for maybe the first time really learning the sciences to such a level of depth that they're able to build theories that are empirically driven, that are really beholden to empirical inquiry in a way that makes us, in some sense, passive viewers. We're science journalists in the sense that our theories require constant vigilance of the science in a way that makes us something like handmaidens to science. The flip side of it, though, is equally true, and I think there is no science without philosophy. Science is about observation, but mere observation is empty. To bring these observations together and construct theories, to even design an experiment, is to have a philosophical idea that's there to be tested, and a sense of argumentation that says what kind of evidence, what kinds of premises could be brought forward to support this theory. So there's this beautiful integration of science and philosophy that's taking place right now. And it's really striking to read philosophical work from just 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and see how utterly absent that engagement with science is. And it's equally striking to read science from previous decades and realize that core questions about emotion, about consciousness, weren't even being asked. So really, in conclusion, I'd want to say we should be thankful, even if these debates are unsettled and unresolved, that we're living through a time where different branches of the academy can work together so successfully.
I like to hear you say that science does need philosophy, despite the major assertions from some leading scientists that science doesn't need philosophy. I very much agree with you on a point that it clearly does. Before I let you go, there's two questions that I try to ask everyone on consciousness, and it's a simple yes or no answer with no additional explanation or clarification of analysis or concepts. There's two questions, yes or no answer, Jesse.
Absolutely.
Do you think it's possible, in theory at least, that a form of computer system could replicate every experience you and I have?
Yes.
Are zombies possible?
No. By coincidence, I was watching an old episode of The Twilight Zone yesterday, and this particular episode takes place on an asteroid where a prisoner has been sentenced to solitary confinement, and to cope with his loneliness, he's given a robot, a female robot, who is quite attentive and fetching and engaging. But this guy, who is cripplingly lonely, feels frustrated by the presence of this robot because he's confident that she can't possibly have conscious feelings. So even though she acts affectionately and seems to care about him, she thinks this has got to be just empty because mere programming could never add up to experience. And I think to look back at that and see what a strong bias we have against the physical, what a deeply culturally entrenched assumption there is that a physical device can't give rise to experience. We can kind of reveal this Cartesian legacy that's still coloring debate in science today. From my perspective, it's absurd to doubt when confronted with such a convincing conversation partner that they're having a rich experiential mental life. So can physical devices that are made out of material other than brain stuff, devices that we construct and program, end up with experience? I think there's really no reason to doubt. To doubt that would be to doubt the physical nature of our own experience. And as I've tried to emphasize, I think those doubts are entirely misplaced.
No, I agree with that to a certain extent. I do think it's quite bizarre how people, whether it's a historical tradition or a general intellectual tradition in society and culture, that people do doubt the immediate effect of how everything you experience, at least at a conscious level, can be triggered by physical stimuli. I know this is not the best extrapolation of an example, but clearly, I mean, everyone could appreciate that the you that wakes up in the middle of the night completely disorientated isn't really the same you that has five cups of coffee. I mean, I think people are, I don't know why it is begrudgingly, but don't want to accept the fact that all our experience, whether consciously and perhaps subconsciously, can be quite dramatically altered, if not determined, by a physical experience. I mean, most people that drink alcohol could appreciate that.
I'm so glad you ended with the example of alcohol, not only because it would be nice to have a drink, but because I think it's exactly the right way to warm people up to the idea that we are just machines. So the very same people who resist physicalism, of course, conduct their lives around activities that involve altering the mind through various physical means. And the, you know, nutrition we get from eating, the rest we get from sleeping, and the mind alteration we get from drinking are all beautiful examples of the ways in which we exploit and depend on and presuppose the machine nature of the mind. And it's only in these abstruse philosophical debates where we step back and doubt something that's so central to the organization of human life.